Hello, I'm John Kelly, and this is a podcast of Mystery Train. For rights reasons, the music is shorter than in the original programme. Mystery Train hits the rails Sunday to Thursday at 7 p.m. on RTE Lyric FM. Thought tonight we'd start with what is literally an overture, the overture to Act One of the opera Heresy, an electronic opera composed by Roger Doyle. And Roger is with me tonight in studio. Every Sunday night we get someone in to pick the music. And tonight I'm glad to say that it is Roger Doyle, composer, musician, and known to many as the godfather of Irish electronica. We'll come to all of that. Roger Doyle, great to have you here.
Great to be here, thanks.
So Roger, we'll talk about all these things as time goes on, but just to get our bearings, where was home for you? Where were you born?
I was born in, physically in the Rotunda Hospital, but I grew up in Malahide.
Yeah.
Very happy childhood in the small village of Malahide as it was then.
Musical household?
No music at all in our household.
Nothing?
At all, nothing, not even a record player or nothing. The next door neighbours had a piano, we didn't. And at the age of 8, I used to go into their house and mess around on their piano and just felt, as a child would, that this piano was a kind of magical thing.
Uh-huh.
And I tried to work a few things out by ear, a few simple melodies. So I actually asked my parents if I could have piano lessons.
Well, that's not, yeah. That, yeah, the other way around.
The other way around, yeah.
And did they agree to that?
They did. Amazingly, they bought a piano and I began lessons and progressed, you know, quite well. I obviously had an aptitude for it up until the age of 16 or so, when I got a bit bored with the lessons and with the actual pieces I was learning, and stopped doing my practice and was actually thrown out of classes. So from 9 to 16, I was a very good student.
A model student.
Yeah.
And what kind of... Now, you were born in, what, 49?
Yeah.
What kind of music appealed to you as a young teenager, let's say?
I think it had to be the Beatles. They were becoming huge around that time, and I felt kind of... they became such a part of my life. You know, you'd have a new Beatles song at that particular party, and you'd know what girl you fancied at that party because of the Beatles song, you know. And the Beatles music really communicated in very emotionally with me. So I think the Beatles would have been it, one after the other, you know. And after a while, I thought, the Beatles are getting really weird now. You know, what are they doing? And I thought some of the albums, like from Revolver onwards, were too weird, amazingly.
Yeah.
But not for long did I think of them as weird.
Well, that's going to come up later on, I know, because I noticed one of the tracks that you've picked on your list is from the White Album. So we'll get to there. Was this interest in the Beatles anything to do with you getting bored with your music lessons?
Yeah. I'd wondered what this glaring Viennese composer, Beethoven, from the distant past, had to do with the rhythms I was feeling and the harmonies I was hearing. That's a bit of a cliche, but that's exactly what
it was. Yeah. But your first choice actually is a piece of classical music, and it's music from Debussy.
Yeah.
One of those composers that people who don't think they like classical music or would say they don't like classical music tend to like Debussy, actually.
Yeah, Debussy was an amazing thing happened to me when I was 15. The BBC television showed the Debussy film, Ken Russell film, fictitious biography, played by Oliver Reed. And I was totally blown away by it. And I didn't really know Debussy's music at the time. So my parents had a Reader's Digest collection of light classical music. We had a record player by then. And so I searched in it and found this one Debussy piece, Petite Suite en Bateau, the orchestral version. So that's my first choice.
Okay. Music there from Debussy, the first choice from Roger Doyle is with me in studio tonight. That was the Orchestre National de Lyon with June Markey conducting Petite Suite, the first movement on Bateau. Roger, we were just talking there during that piece of music, and it's going to be hard with you, I know, to try and keep myself on track because your musical interests are wide and varied. But just to get back to classical music and you're playing piano, presumably you're playing Beethoven, Mozart, Schubert, all that kind of thing.
Yeah.
When you heard someone like Debussy for the first time, and even though that piece was quite, you know, traditional in a way.
Gentle, yeah.
Yeah. When you heard Debussy for the first time, did you think, here's something, this is different now, this is very different?
Yeah, I suppose this piece just has an emotional echo for me because it was the piece I went to that drew me towards Debussy. But overall, Debussy's music, it's the harmonies that get me. Yeah. They had a magical effect on the young teenager who was me. I can't quite explain it because I studied harmony, you know, for many years, and all the pitfalls of putting the wrong note here and there, and think you're doing fine, but you've accidentally put in an augmented second when you shouldn't have, and all of this. I studied harmony, and it meant absolutely nothing to me. But listening to Debussy's harmony had a special, very special effect, and harmony generally is something I'm big on.
And he was, of course, a real pioneer then in terms of how music went on to change.
He started it, as many people have said. He started I think when we hit the 20th century, everything changed, absolutely everything. But you could say Debussy started the avalanche or something like that. There's a quote which inspired me many years ago, and I actually put it in a printed literature about myself. He said, "The century of aeroplanes has a right to a music of its own."
Wow.
And he foretold that things were going to change big time, and presumably that technology was going to change everything.
And when you discovered Debussy, did you then start to follow that line and find all those composers that were so radical at the time?
Yeah. Well, two things happened then. One was Stravinsky, which we're going to play a bit of, and the other one was jazz. So I began to listen to a lot of piano jazz, Dave Brubeck in particular, and I tried to teach myself a little bit of piano jazz, and that's what I spent my time doing instead of my Beethoven and my Chopin. I'd come to lessons saying, "Hey, look, do you want to hear this? I've been trying this out," and my teacher would sort of nod and internally say, thought, "I'm getting rid of this guy. This is going nowhere," which is sad because I should have been encouraged, really.
Yeah, I mean, I know classical music is, you know, it's notated, and in theory there's no improvisation, although there is, and jazz is supposedly improvised all the time. And yet there's huge crossover, isn't there, in terms of particular composers and jazz musicians who are very, very fond of Stravinsky, very fond of Debussy.
Yeah, Stravinsky, Debussy, Ravel. Stravinsky is an interesting case because he never heard jazz. He saw notated jazz. He was in Switzerland at the time. He never actually heard it, but he wrote some jazz pieces, notably The Soldier's Tale, which is, you know, really amazing virtuoso piece with you know, very obvious jazz influences. And I think it's really amazing that he just did it from looking at scores.
I often tell this story. I interviewed a jazz musician, Red Rodney, who played with Charlie Parker. And he told me that one night in New York, Charlie Parker was playing and Stravinsky was in the audience. And Red Rodney looked out through the curtain and saw Stravinsky there and told Charlie Parker, "You never believe who's in the front row." So Charlie Parker went out on stage and opened the set with a little bit of Firebird.
Wow.
And Stravinsky apparently dropped his glass. You know, dropped whatever he was drinking. He dropped it on the floor. He was so pleased, you know, to be acknowledged and all that kind of thing. But they were interested in what each other were up to, I think, at that time.
Yeah, absolutely. I'm reminded that Stravinsky liked the bass lines of the guy. What's the guy who played bass in the band called Cream?
Oh, Jack Bruce.
Yeah,
Really?
Yeah. He actually commented on Jack Bruce's bass lines.
All right. Well, listen, why don't we just... It's not exactly in the order that you've made them here, but we should probably play the Stravinsky now, actually, having just spoken about him. And you've chosen the first tableau from Petrushka, which was a ballet, wasn't it?
Yeah. What he did in Petrushka, you know, written in 1911, is absolutely amazing. He tried to give the impression of a fairground with all kinds of different stuff happening at the same time. So he set himself huge kind of task. How do I do this? How do I notate this? And also he brings in all kinds of different musics. A little sad waltz comes in, but it's cut short. You hear music coming on top of other music. How did he do that? If you have a quick look at the score, you'll see that he wrote melodies five notes in the time of four, a whole section close to the beginning. So, you know, technically and imaginatively, it's an extraordinary piece.
Music there from Stravinsky, chosen by Roger Doyle, the part of the tableau number one from Petrushka. The Philadelphia Orchestra, Ricardo Muti conducting. I noticed that next on the list here, Roger, are the Beach Boys.
Mm.
Now, were you comfortably at then? Did you get to some point where you were comfortably listening to all kinds of music and treating it all equally?
Yeah, I was a drummer. I started being a drummer at around the age of 15 as well. So I was studying classical piano. I was drumming in pop groups and we were playing Hollies and Beatles numbers. And I had jazz was going too. I hadn't yet discovered electronic music, but, you know, it was all going on. And around the same time, I was thrown out of piano classes. So I was listening to a lot of pop music. And for me, God Only Knows by the Beach Boys. Again, if you were to ask me one of the best pop songs ever written in the history of pop, I would say this is it, even above the Beatles, who I love so much. And it, to me, this is the summer of 1966, you know, what I was doing, who I was with, and what parties we were at.
I'm not asking any of those questions. I don't know how many times I've heard that, Roger, but it always just sounds amazing, doesn't it?
Keeps doing it every time, yeah.
What have you analysed what's going on there?
Yeah, I once got the chord charts for it. They're all very complex chords and all kinds of first and second inversions and positions of the chords you wouldn't expect, especially in the left hand. So it's far more, it sounds smooth on the surface, but underneath there's you know, I mentioned harmony earlier. The harmonies are quite complex.
And he was just a kid, you know, when he wrote that.
Yeah.
Just a young man. But then, I suppose,
just feeling it on the piano, feeling the positions on the keyboard.
I guess the only explanation for it, if I don't know if you accept the term or not, is genius.
Yeah, no, I do accept the term.
It seems to be the only way of...
The whole album that was released on Pet Sounds, the whole album, genius.
He was lucky he found people who could play it for him too. That's the other thing. Some musicians or composers can conceive of stuff, but there's nobody to play it.
Yeah, he got this band of session musicians in, specialists who learned it and played it, yeah.
Extraordinary. So there you were, classical music, pop music, and you mentioned jazz.
Mm.
Now, you can't, well, maybe you could, but normally you can't just go from being a drummer in a pop group to becoming a jazz drummer. Jazz drummers are very often trained and trained very hard.
Yeah, my training was just listening. I did. That's exactly what happened. I went from being a pop drummer to a jazz drummer. I remember writing an article for the school magazine about how being a jazz drummer, this is before I was a jazz rock drummer, actually, how difficult that must be. But I had, I did it, and I played in a band for many years called Supply, Demand and Curve. And one of the things they did was jazz rock. And just by listening, you know, I didn't have the greatest technique in the world, but, you know, I was able to do enough to make it sound convincing.
And who were you listening to in particular to emulate?
John McLaughlin, for instance. The Inner Mounting Flame, that album. King Crimson were doing
so it was,
crazy stuff.
You weren't so much listening to, you know, Kenny Clarke or, you know, the sort of the big bebop jazz.
That's
drummers,
true,
that
I wasn't,
sort of thing,
no.
Yeah.
No.
So jazz rock give you a way
it
in.
It was jazz rock, really. And prog rock, like bands like Yes,
yeah,
had a huge influence on my drumming. Basically, you know, so many musicians just need, as Debussy himself said, just need a good pair of ears and a willingness to learn.
Now, prog rock, of course, is looked down upon. In fact, well, it's not anymore. I think people are starting to reassess it now. But there was a period where prog rock really was a kind of a dirty word, wasn't it?
Two dirty words. I could never understand that because the musicianship reached, you know, a
but
zenith.
Wasn't that the problem, though? The musicianship was extraordinary, but what they were producing didn't amount to much.
Well, I can see why people might say that, except for, you know, I could name albums by Yes and by... Genesis.
Emerson, Lake and Palmer.
I saw Emerson, Lake and Palmer at the Isle of Wight Festival, 1970. I saw Jimi Hendrix.
Really?
Yeah.
Wow.
Jimmy's drummer. Wow.
Well, the thing about the prog side of it is, while it was a big casualty of the punk years and so on, I think now people are reassessing it. And there's an awful lot of music coming out at the moment, which is really cool and really hip.
Yes.
But when you stand back and listen to it, you go, actually, that's prog rock. And I include Radiohead and all those bands in that.
Yeah, and there's some really interesting bands. Math Rock is another one.
Math Rock. Right. And Post Rock. It's been around for a while as well.
There's unusual time signatures.
And, yeah.
I love it. Math Rock now is an interesting one.
Math Rock. But there isn't a prog rock
no.
on your list, however. There doesn't seem to be. But before we get into the electronic side of things, let's play. You've got Paul Brady down here.
Yeah.
And this is no particular sequence, but you clearly have a thing about songwriting. Do you know, it's sometimes composers like yourself and musicians and people who are into the kind of music you're into tend to overlook the singer-songwriter type thing. But you obviously have a great respect, and you've mentioned Brian Wilson already, for someone who writes a hell of a good pop song.
Oh, yeah, I've done pop music myself too. So I've had a go at it, you know,
yeah.
on occasion. I had a go at practically everything, really. But Paul Brady wrote this song called Nobody Knows, and I just found it a very emotional connection to it, whether it's the way the harmonies move, the melody or the words are great, the production is fantastic, the playing on it. I think it's one of the most beautiful songs of the entire 1980s. And I had an opportunity to tell Paul to his face socially. I met him to tell him what a bloody wonderful song it was. And it was great to be able to say that to somebody, you know, to think it from a distance, but to say it to their face is very special.
Nobody Knows. Paul Brady, Nobody Knows. The choice of Roger Doyle is with me tonight in studio, picking all the tracks. So you're fond of a good pop song, well executed, and that seems to be just even your reaction to that one the whole way through. You really love that song.
I love it. If I ever overhear it in on the street or in a restaurant, I just stop what I'm doing and just pay attention.
Now, your next choice takes us into the world of electronica, and it was probably the first... I have a single of this at home, and it was probably the first, I suppose, electronic act that I kind of got to like. Because when you grew up... Back then, when you grew up with guitars, electronica was a bit... We were all kind of suspicious of it. Because, we saw people on top of the Pops playing...
Oh, yeah. Two notes. Fingers.
Yeah, two fingers.
Yeah.
So when did you first encounter what we would call electronic music?
Oh, I guess... 1969.
Yeah, you see, that's...
You see, I'm a bit...
That's way back.
A little bit older. But I was still a teenager, just about.
Yeah.
The music of Pierre Henry, the French composer. It was the first time I ever heard electronic music.
And was this what they call music concrete?
Music concrete.
So what is that exactly?
It's not really like electronic, but it's more abstracted, without rhythms, electronic music.
And is that the definition, then, of music concrete? Is that what that is?
I think the definition of music concrete is simply music which is can be recorded by microphone and then screwed around with.
Right.
It's basically taking material and doing things with it, which can be anything, you know, making something go backwards or adding reverb or slowing it down, speeding it up. Those are the classic techniques of those days, late 60s.
And you're talking about Pierre Henry.
Pierre Henry, yeah.
Was he? I mean, who's the first at anything? But was he the first?
Was
he
the? It was one of the first. Yeah, in a studio in Paris, the Groupe de Musique, GRM, the Groupe de Recherche Musicale. Yeah, he was in there with a guy called Pierre Schaeffer. The two of them were maybe the first people to experiment with this oscillators and tape recorders. And Stockhausen was there too, doing his own different thing, which was music created largely by electronic means. When I say that, it's not actually true either, because I'm going to play maybe a bit of Stockhausen later on, where he does use music concrete techniques. But basically, it's playing with technology to transform.
I mean, that was quite a leap, wasn't it? Because presumably people thought they were crazy.
I don't think they did. When I was in Paris, there was this show on with Pierre Henry and the Maurice Béjart Dance Company. And it was a huge hit in Paris. It seems like it was happening in France, it was happening big in Germany. There was Princeton Studios in the States. It was happening. It just wasn't happening here. Mm. And it wasn't really happening in Great Britain either until the 1980s, when you had electronica or, you know, pop music using electronic instruments. That was different.
So this music had been going on for a long time in the classical world, I guess. Is that how you would... On the margins of the classical world?
It's a whole other cousin, I suppose. It's a whole other relation. And those cousins didn't really talk to each other much. I don't think there was much crossover in those days.
Because if you look now at an encyclopedia of classical music or a dictionary of composers and so on, when you get towards the end, you start to encounter names like Varese and people like that, who all were working with electronics, as far as I can tell.
He was given the opportunity late in life, working with electronics. He tried to set up an electronic studio in the 1930s and didn't succeed. So when others were doing it in the late 40s and early 50s, they invited this then old man in. Would you like to do some? And he did do a couple of pieces in 1958 and 60. But he also wrote amazing orchestral music and percussion pieces, which Frank Zappa loved and hugely influenced him. So the whole thing kind of moves forwards and sideways. And
it's great the way things tie up like that, you know, because as I said, when we were watching Top of the Pops, when I was watching Top of the Pops at that stage and taking a real dislike to these guys playing two notes, I didn't know there was any history to it, you know. I didn't know there was any, I thought these were just chancers. And a lot of some of them were. But then some of them turned out not to be. I used to hate Depeche Mode, and they actually turned out to be a great band.
I never really took to them, but there was people like Thomas Dolby, fantastic. Kate Bush used technology in really beautiful ways, and orchestral maneuvers in the dark.
Exactly. But we're going to play Japan.
Oh, are we? Oh, sorry.
Well, we're going to play
Japan also.
Well, we can play. We can play both.
Yeah.
I'll tell you what. Let's play Orchestral Maneuvers in the Dark. Who are more? They were one of those bands I wasn't sure about at all.
Me too. Until this
Souvenir OMD. Souvenir from Orchestral Maneuvers in the Dark. The choice of Roger Doyle is with me in studio tonight. Roger, that was 1981, and we were just saying there, it just occurred to me in the middle of that your group, Operating Theatre, was also formed in 1981. And
yeah.
Was it on the back of that sort of scene that you got together?
Yeah. In the 70s, I was doing completely kind of abstract, experimental, electronic music, concrete music. compositions.
When it wasn't popular nor profitable.
It wasn't profit. No, it wasn't either of those things.
Well, let me just hold you there for a moment. Mm. When you were doing that, Roger, what was your working life like? Because again, I mean, was there anybody else in Ireland doing that?
No,
I wouldn't
nobody.
Have thought so.
No, I had won a scholarship to study electronic music in Holland, so I learned a lot of the techniques of what people like Stockhausen were doing. I learned how to do it, and I went back several times as guest composer to the Institute of Sonology in Utrecht, and I was deadly serious about composing, you know, innovative, big. I even had an idea. You know, Stravinsky composed these three amazing ballets before he was 30, and I thought, I'm going to compose three amazing electronic pieces before I'm 30. And one of them was called the Rapid Eye Movements, which is a 30-minute piece, which I was determined. I think I put it on the program notes or on the album cover. My masterpiece before the age of 30, in quotation marks.
Yeah.
Semi-seriously, but of course I absolutely meant it.
Yeah. And, you know, these pieces have all survived, you know? They have all survived. But to be working as someone making abstract electronic pieces in the 70s in Ireland must have been a lonely station.
Not really. I mean, you've got the music to keep your company.
Yeah. So, okay, well, you were doing that, and then suddenly, I suppose, the culture started to move up around what you were already doing. Popular culture did, anyway.
Yeah, I achieved those three pieces, you know, I thought, right, I've done that. Let's let the pop thing come to the surface. It's always been brewing there. Let's have a go at it. And myself and Alwyn Fuere formed this music theatre company, Operating Theatre. And the first thing we did was we released a single on CBS Records, a pop single, you know. And then that was 1981. In 82, we did another one. And in 85, we did another one with Mother Records, the label.
That was U2's
set up
label,
by U2.
Did Bono produce that?
Yeah, Bono produced it, and he even played guitar on a track called Queen of No Heart.
Right.
I remember Bono saying, what chord is that now? And I was, you know, what chords are those? And I was sort of in an offhand way saying, oh, they're six-note chords. You wouldn't be interested. And he said, no, what are they? What's the top two notes? And he played the top two notes and added a whammy bar to it. You know? And it's on the recording and it works great.
Very good. You know? And Operating Theatre, you mentioned yourself and Alwyn, who's obviously a very well-known actor that, you know, and we've often seen her perform and I've interviewed her and so on. Was Operating Theatre, was it a movable feast that was basically you, or was there an actual band beyond you and Alwyn?
Yeah, there was two things. There was the band, and we had different members. We had a trombonist, and we had different drummers, and we had different people in the band for each recording. But we were also a theatre company, and we started commissioning writers, including Sebastian Barry's first ever play. We did all kinds of unusual plays. And the plan behind it was that the music would play a central role in the theatrical experience, because too often theatre that we saw was people sitting around talking, people on the stage standing around talking.
In kitchens, talking in kitchens.
This music hasn't been used really properly in theatre. Let's have a go at it.
And was it a productive time? I mean, did you get to do plenty of work?
Yeah, we were active nonstop from 81 till 88. We ended up going to the Caracas Theatre Festival in Venezuela. We went to France. We went to America. We did a tour of Holland. I applied to the Dutch Arts Council to do a show, and we got the money, much to my amazement. Then we closed it down for 10 years and started it all off again in 1999, where we did some crazy pieces in glass rooms in a hotel or in a big empty warehouse on Thomas Street, crazy stuff. And we closed it down finally in 2008.
Now, back to 19, the 1980s, we just heard Orchestral Manoeuvres in the Dark. And the single that I'm talking about, which is one of the first I bought from by a band that wasn't a rock band as such, was Japan.
Yeah.
David Sylvian turned out to be a really interesting musician, didn't he?
Yeah. Especially when he teamed up with Sakamoto.
Yeah.
But in this, yeah, I only knew him then as the singer with Japan. And they made an extraordinary album, I think, an album called Tin Drum. And every single track on it, I think, is extraordinary. I don't think they ever equaled that. This track called Ghosts, it got into the charts. I think it got to number five.
It was a big hit.
Number five in the charts.
I have the single. I still have it.
Yeah, amazing. Have it.
Ghosts, Japan. Echo, a stain from Björk, before that Japan and Ghost, the choices of Roger Doyle is with me in studio. We're going to take a quick break. We'll be right back and we'll talk about Björk. And this is Mystery Train, RTE Lyric FM, the Sunday night special where we get someone to pick the tunes. Tonight, Roger Doyle is with me in studio. Roger, just before that break, we played Björk and Echo, a stain. And you particularly love that album, Vespertine. There's quite a lot of good stuff on there.
Yeah, I could have picked any one of maybe six tracks from that. I think as an album, it really stands up. It's 18 or so years ago since that came out. Time travels so fast, but I think it's just a super album.
Now, there are terrific electronic sounds all over that record.
Yeah.
You were making the point, and I guess it comes down to that question of using the studio as an instrument. You were working on your own since the 1970s making electronica.
Yeah.
She has a team of people.
I'd love to have a team. Yeah.
Because the studio, I mean, you can do anything in a studio now, basically, sonically, can't you?
Yeah, if you just have the ideas, and if you follow the changing technologies and have the input of people with interesting, different brains than yours, it must be fantastic. I've just been able to use, from my own, the main body of my work, it's me on my own in the studio, but of course I work a lot with singers and with instrumentalists, coaxing things from them. So that part of it is great.
Now, tell me about, the one thing I didn't clarify when I was talking to you was your musical education, apart from, I think we left it when you quit your piano lessons. Mm. But what about formal education?
Yeah, when I left school, having studied the piano and harmony for many years, maybe it's worth saying that I was sitting around the house doing nothing when I was 18, wondering what the hell to do.
Yeah, well, it might have been time well spent, actually.
Yeah, I doodled at the piano and wrote down a 4-page piano piece and actually showed it to the teacher who discontinued my studies. And she said that she would show it to the professor of composition at the Royal Irish Academy of Music, Dr. A.J. Potter. Right. So I went in and I played him my 4-page piece at the age of 18. And he took me on as a composition student. For 3 years. So that was the main part of what I would call training.
What was that composition like? What sort of ballpark was it in?
It was a very conventional piano piece, but it had a couple of slightly interesting harmonies in the left hand. nothing great, but you know, enough to... In those days, there wasn't such an amount. There weren't the dozens and scores of composers vying for attention that there are now. So in all modesty, I would say that maybe, you know, it was easier to get in to the academy in those days.
And what about, you know, by the time you'd finished at the academy, how were your compositional skills, or where were you at as a composer, would you say?
I covered a lot of ground. In the first year, I got a scholarship, junior composition scholarship, which meant I could have the second year without paying a fee.
Yeah.
And at the end of the second year, I got the Van der Leer scholarship, which meant I could get the third year free. But in the third year, I was starting to compose with tape recorders. I just got a cheap tape recorder.
Now, what year was this? Because I'm now thinking of Steve Reich and people like that. When were you doing this?
1970.
Right.
1971.
Okay. Yeah, well, you were on the money there then.
Yeah, I never really stopped and thought. I just thought, when I heard the Pierre Henry music and the Stockhausen music, it just, you need a tape recorder. You can't do this without having a tape recorder. And in a very childish way, I got a cheap tape recorder and just started messing around.
And was the Academy open to that?
No, they didn't give me any scholarship then when they heard these other pieces. But there wasn't a degree. There is now, but there wasn't a degree to get at the end of 3 years.
Right.
So I left. But I did apply for a scholarship to study electronic music in Holland. And for that, it was like a post-grad scholarship. You needed strong letters of support. So I got these very nice letters from the two teachers I'd had at the Academy of Music, Dr. A.J. Potter and James Wilson, who recommended me for these scholarships. So it really was to my benefit that I had done those 3 years.
So where did Stockhausen come into the picture? Because you said you actually studied, you know, figured out how to do things from studying Stockhausen.
Yeah, he's on the cover, as everyone maybe knows, of the Sgt. Pepper album. And it's the same year he did a piece called Hymnen. And when I first heard Hymnen, probably about 1971, around the same time, I heard Hymnen on a friend's double LP. He said, "This is a load of rubbish. Would you like it?" And I loved it. And Hymnen means anthems, and he takes the national anthems of different countries of the world and does things with them. Really took everything to a whole new level. Took technology. I still don't know, you know, how he did it. In the studios in Germany, West German radio's electronic music studio, and Hymnen literally blew my mind. Can't really describe it.
And yet you can see why your friend would have had difficulty with it, because nobody would have heard music like this before.
No. It's one of those things, you know. For me, electronic music was like almost making a connection with something that that I knew already existed inside of me. How do you describe that?
Don't even try. Music there from Hymnen from Stockhausen, the choice of Roger Doyle. I was hoping you'd have Stockhausen on your list, and I suspected you would. It's good to hear you talk about him. We're going to play the Beatles in a minute. You mentioned the Sgt. Pepper cover, but he had a big influence musically. They say on John Lennon, but I suspect McCartney was the one. I don't know for sure. But he had... could you describe then how someone like him making music in this very, very specific, rarefied corner of music could become so influential on popular culture?
Stockhausen, yes, he was like a pop star in those different circles. I mean, he was a huge figure, and maybe he had a very persuasive personality and kind of bossed people around. So the word was that you know, if Stockhausen wants something done, you do it his way, you don't argue. Mm. I heard that on many occasions. I talked about Hymnen from 1967, but in 1969, the Beatles, I don't know which one of them, must have heard Hymnen. In fact, there's a bit in Hymnen where the guy says, number nine, you know, that's in Hymnen. So we get to the Beatles, 1969, just 2 years later, and the track called Revolution, number nine, which was an 8-track tape recorder, which they filled up with as a collage and put stuff against other stuff, bits of text, bits of music, bits of tape loops, orchestras going backwards, all of that stuff. But the amazing thing is, okay, it's a 9-minute piece, and we'll probably hear a bit of it. It really holds together as a piece of music. It's not just a mess. It has coherence, and it had a huge impact on me. And I was just about 20 at this stage.
Okay, here we go. Revolution number 9, the Beatles.
Number 9. Number nine.
Number nine. Number nine. Music there from the Beatles Revolution number 9, the choice of Roger Doyle, who's with me in studio. Roger, you mentioned at the top of the programme loving the Beatles when you were a kid and finding a Revolver and Rubber Soul kind of a bit too adventurous back then.
Yeah.
When you listened to that, the White Album, for instance, with your training, the training you already had in electronic music, and you knew Stockhausen and so on, you were impressed by that. It wasn't just a bunch of kind of messers who had heard a little bit of it and were messing around in the studio. This was the real thing.
This was, yeah, it coheres. It really is put together in a very musical way. Okay, don't ask me to be too specific yeah. about that.
But you can imagine the reaction, you know, if you were a Mop Top fan.
Yeah, the Beatles expanded me. That's the best way I can think of it, because I thought they were getting a bit weird myself.
Yeah.
And then after a while I thought, no, they're not so weird. It's actually rather marvellous what yeah. they're doing. And then they moved on to another album and I thought, God, they really are weird now. But then because I was open to it, as was nearly everybody, they expanded my consciousness and my musical ear and my worldview of music. I suppose they educated. It's a kind of education.
Mm. And they were being educated themselves as they went along.
Yeah.
They were picking stuff up, yeah.
We're all educated.
Yeah, at the same time.
Yeah.
But you also mentioned, you know, you played a Brian Wilson track, a Beach Boys track at the start of the programme, and a lot of those albums you're talking about came about as a result of a sort of a friendly rivalry between the Beatles and the Beach Boys.
Absolutely, yes. When Paul McCartney heard Pet Sounds by the Beach Boys, yeah. he thought, okay,
right,
that's put it up to us.
The gauntlet has been thrown down.
The gauntlet.
Yeah.
What can we? We're going to show him. Yeah, and they did.
Now you went on your on further studies. Then you went to the Netherlands. You went. Now, did you say you went to Helsinki as well?
Yeah, I spent a year at the Finnish Radio Experimental Music Studio again on a government scholarship for a year.
Do we have one of those here? An Irish Radio Experimental Electronic Music
no,
Studio?
No, sadly,
we should. Well. We should start one. So, and what was Helsinki like then? What happened there?
Well, the choice for Helsinki was made partly because my first wife was Finnish, so but we were living in Ireland. But we spent a year there, and when I got to the studio, it was only me and one other composer there, so I had the whole place to myself for pretty much a year. But they didn't have any, they just had lots of tape recorders. They didn't have an actual multi-track tape recorder.
Right.
They just had loads of stereo tape recorders.
And by the way, when you mentioned tape recorder now, did you adjust easily to digital when tape became a thing
of
the past?
No, I didn't. I didn't
no.
know what digital was.
Yeah.
It was explained to me 10 times and I still didn't get it.
And where are you at with it now?
Well, I hope it doesn't change too much. I'm very comfortable with working on screen,
yeah.
you know. But
would you rather be using tape?
No, I wouldn't. No, I love what I love the technology.
Yeah.
I've been totally won over by it, and I'll never go back
yeah.
to the old ways. Oh, I did thousands, maybe 10,000, 20,000 edits with razor blade and the special editing tape. Yeah,
it was a very satisfying procedure, I think.
In fact, if you put one of my master tapes, like this piece, Rapid Eye Movements, if you put it on a tape machine, you'll just see all these thousands of edits going yeah. by as you watch it.
And then searching around on the floor for one that you...
Oh, I had them all around my neck.
Yeah.
I had five strands around my neck at any given time to take in and take out. And sometimes I'd forget which strand I had, you know, put the wrong one in.
I kind of miss that.
I don't.
Yeah, maybe not. Okay. Was it in Helsinki that you saw Frank Zappa?
Yeah. He came to Helsinki on his tour. I was there from 76 to 77. I think it was around January 77. I'm not quite sure. He came and I was in about the third row. And I was a big fan already by then. And he had the most amazing drummer I've ever seen in my life, Terry Bozzio, on drums. And Terry, there are videos still online of Terry, total madman on the drum kit. There was one thing he did where he stood up on the seat, on the drums seat, and jumped off it and smashed himself into the kit at 100 miles an hour with arms flailing. at the beginning of his solo. It was just so exciting.
And where do you rate, again, we were talking earlier, you know, about, I mentioned these dictionaries of composers. And when it gets to Z, Zappa will often feature. And, if you don't know Zappa's work, you kind of might have a picture of him, which is a very limited idea of what he's about. A kind of a hippie rock star kind of a guy. But yeah. The word serious is not the word I mean to use, but he was a serious musician as well.
Yeah, he was all of those things. And he did work of various degrees, in my view. He did some really dreadful stuff as well as amazing stuff. And he covered a huge range. But I suppose the best thing about him was that he gathered bands. He made bands and paid for rehearsals and gathered the top musicians around him and went out touring and really put on a show.
And how would you describe, for instance, Zappa's sort of lineage musically going back? Where did Zappa come from, do you think? From the more avant-garde side of things?
I guess he came from Varese and Stravinsky. They were and doo-wop music of the 50s.
Oh, what a combination.
Actually. Yeah.
Stravinsky and doo-wop.
Yeah.
Brilliant.
And made albums paying homage to all of that. And then he got hold of technology and he acquired a thing called a synclavier, which was a digital computer synthesizer, similar to the Fairlight computer synthesizer that I worked with here.
You mentioned Kate Bush earlier, which she had.
Yes, she worked with the Fairlight.
Yeah, mastered the whole how to use it herself.
Yeah.
At a time when nobody else was using them, I think.
I mastered how to do it too. Wow. In the studio in Dublin, had one. I obviously didn't have the money to buy it, but I was part of a team that used it. And I even bought it after a while because it was gathering dust in the corner of the studio. I bought it for 1/10 of the price it cost. Wow. But Zappa made some really great music, especially an album called Jazz from Hell. And one of his very, very last albums he made was called Civilization Phase 3, which was just all done on this computer synthesizer.
What would you like to hear from this album, Roger? This is the last album he made, Civilization Phase?
There was one more that came out called The Yellow Shark.
Right.
But this is the last one he did using this new technology of the day, because he couldn't play anymore. All he could do was work in the studio in his basement of his house.
And this is called Amnerica.
Yeah.
Or Amnerica. Amnerica. Frank Zappa. Music there from Frank Zappa, Amnerica from Civilization Phase. The choice of Roger Doyle is with me in studio. Again, in terms of musical labels, what was that? You know what I mean? It'd be very hard to say what it is, you know?
Yeah.
And if you told people it was Frank Zappa, that's not the Frank Zappa they know.
People talk about music falling between the cracks, but this, it's all cracks. It's falling apart.
It is. Now, we'll have one of yours, Roger, from Passade, Volume 1. Tell me a little bit about this piece of music. We're going to play the opening.
Yeah. Where to start? It's a piece of technology, yes. I'm inspired by technology. And there's a piece of technology called Freeze Program, which was a part of a package brought out by the GRM, the Groupe de Recherche Musicale.
When you say a package, what does that mean?
A software package, which did different things. And one of them is called Freeze.
Right.
And it literally will take an incoming sound and freeze it like a freeze frame in a video or DVD. Mm-hmm. The audio equivalent of freezing something, yeah. which in itself is, when you hear it, it's really interesting to have a sound just frozen. Of course, frozen in time would mean silence, but this with very careful internal micro looping, you get this impression of a sound standing still.
Right.
And then you can manipulate that with the mouse like a calligrapher. Then move the sound slowly backwards and forwards. And this is what I did in this piece. And a passade is an equestrian term meaning to move backwards and forwards over the same space. So the word actually describes very well what's happening in the music. And I composed the passades for about 5 years. I did 3 albums worth of them. And for me, this kind of introduces the listener, I hope, to a world of wonder and maybe ancient civilizations or something. I don't know.
Okay. Passade. Opening. Roger Doyle with me in studio tonight, picking the music. That, however, is one of his own. We thought we should play some of Roger's own music. The passades you described earlier on, you know, moving backwards and forwards on the same space, which is kind of an interesting concept, something to listen to. You did hours of these, 5 years' work worth of passades or passade.
I did, yeah.
And then I think of Babel as well, which was a huge, 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 huge project.
10 years.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Now, that level of commitment to an idea, not everybody would do that, except perhaps maybe a novelist or someone who would spend 5 years writing a book.
Yeah, it's the same sort of... you need to be obsessive. I didn't know I had this obsessive streak when I was 18, hanging around the house, playing poker and smoking cigarettes. But as the years went on, I realised I do have an obsessive streak and put it to very good use. I used to teach in Trinity and I used to say to the students, if you don't have an obsessive streak, get one quickly, you know. I spent 10 years on one project called Babel, where I tried to compose music from an imaginary Tower of Babel, and each track was a different room in this Tower of Babel in a different language, different musical language. I like to celebrate all these languages I use. And Babel was not a confusion of languages for me. It was a celebration of the multiplicity of language. But when I finished Babel, I was wondering, looking around for something else to do, and I discovered literally just this one piece of software. And messing around in the studio with it, I thought, this has huge possibilities. Supposing I start layering all these and crossfading them and doing different things with them. And I produced one volume of 50 minutes or so. And then I thought, let's do another one, let's keep going. And the pieces would proliferate. As I was finishing one lot, I'd be already into doing the next one. I finished volume two and I thought, that's it. Volume two had such a beautiful fading out ending. I thought, that's such a beautiful ending. It can't go any further. But the following year I did volume three, which is perhaps the best of them all.
Yeah. I really admire anybody who can find so much, you know, from... I was going to say so little, that's not the case, but from an idea, idea.
It's not that, you know, it's as I've said this before, music has saved my life, you could say. It actually has, you know, when I look back, I actually have diaries from when I was 18, doing nothing. And without music, I don't know what I would have ended up at, you know. I scraped a pass in the leaving in school, so... I wasn't heading for any great career anywhere else. So you move towards the thing that's going to change your life and save your life. Then I discovered I can do this. I'm not bad, you know. I actually, you know, I can do this. I'm quite good at it.
Now, the other thing I wanted to ask you about, listening to that, which we just played, which is from 02 and 03.
Yeah.
I hear an awful lot of music, contemporary music. Brand new music everybody's talking about. And it's that kind of music that you were composing a long, 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 long time ago. Does it bother you at all when you hear music coming out now and everybody says this is cutting edge music? And you think, well, actually, you know, I've been doing this for a long time myself.
It doesn't bother me musically, no. Sometimes it bothers me a bit to see other musicians doing well when you think, I'm better than them. Why aren't I doing as well as they? Yeah. But everyone, I guess, every artist will feel that.
Yeah. Look, I'm just making the point that you were there first. So your next choice is for music for people who like art. So tell me a little bit about this. And again, we can't play all of it because this is a long piece. This is by Andrew Hamilton, yeah?
Yeah. You know, if you ask me what's happening today in Ireland with the interesting composers, there's quite a few. You know, we have a range of huge talent in this country, lots of great composers. And some of them are sort of jockeying for position in a kind of post-minimalist world. And Andrew Hamilton has been doing that. In his experimentation and looking for something new, he's actually come up, I think, with something brand new. And I was at a performance of this piece in the concert hall, and it's incredibly funny and disturbing at the same time. And he kind of deconstructs harmony, and the music doesn't go anywhere. That's the amazing thing. It doesn't go anywhere. It just looks at something again and again and again with minor changes, as though you've got a record or a CD that's stuck every now and then. And as an audience member, you're kind of laughing, giggling internally and being very disturbed at the same time.
I like this already.
I think he's come up with something really original.
Okay, Andrew Hamilton, music for people who like art. Music there from Andrew Hamilton. The choice of Roger Doyle is with me in the studio. That was a Crash Ensemble there. Michelle O'Rourke was the singer. And you can see, Roger, I think one of the reasons that would make you very uncomfortable is the terror of it all going wrong, because that's a high wire act, isn't it?
Absolutely. If any of the members of the Crash Ensemble or if she comes in even a quarter of a beat late or early or misses a cue, and I've seen it done live, you know, without any mistakes, it's unbelievable. It's a longish piece. It's a 25-minute piece or so, and it gets crazier as it goes on. She starts coughing, and it's all in the score, but it's just beautifully crazy.
A lot of, you mentioned Steve Reich and what we've just heard, which is clearly kind of, there's a connection there, all right, and with Philip Glass too. You can kind of hear touches of that, I guess. If you're there in the concert hall,
yeah,
you kind of need to be there to get the full effect of it.
That's true with this recording. I miss the acoustic. It's a little dry for me, that recording. I miss the acoustic of the live experience.
You get a bit of an echo or reverb coming back at you.
Yeah, being there, of course, seeing Michelle and seeing them all doing their thing makes it even more uncomfortable in a good way.
Now, if you staged something like that in New York or Paris, you'd get an audience for it, you know? And I'm just wondering what it's like in Ireland, how open-minded people are.
Well, the Crash Ensemble, they're doing a great job. You know, they've got a good following, and they make a big effort to go out and get audiences. I think the Crash are very active. They're playing all over the world. And
they don't pull their punches either. I mean, they do their stuff. They do their thing.
Fantastic musicians. I worked with them just last year. I worked with them. And to have musicians of such virtuosity, where you know you can write something difficult and they'll sail through it, you know, it's such a thrill.
Your next choice is Michael Jackson.
Oh, yeah.
Tell me about your relationship with Michael Jackson.
Well, Michael and I were great friends. No.
From the operating theatre days.
Yeah. Yes. Again, as part of it, it's the technique of the production. I find the sounds of the rhythm section here just crazy. But also what I love about Michael Jackson is the tension you feel when you're listening to a Michael Jackson. You feel as though you want to kind of, I don't know, pull your shirt off or something.
steady on.
It's the wonderful tension of listening to Michael Jackson. He never lets go. And this rhythm, the rhythm track on this, it just makes you want to, you know, jump up and down and tear your shirt off.
Wish this was television. You Drives Me Wild, Michael Jackson, the choice of Roger Doyle. You were enjoying that.
You jumping were. Up and down.
Yeah. Well, it's hard to resist drums like that, really. I want to talk about a couple of things that are coming up which involve you very closely. On Tuesday night, this Tuesday coming, am I right? This Tuesday coming, Tuesday the 18th at the IFI at 6:30, there's a film which you wrote the soundtrack for it called The Bishop's Story, which is formerly known as Budawani. So tell me what's happening there.
Yeah, Irish filmmaker Bob Quinn made a film with Donald McCann in the lead role, and he wanted to shoot it in black and white and with no live sound. Bob and I had worked together on this. Now, we're going back a good bit. We're going back to the 1980s here. He asked me to compose 70 minutes of music so that when anybody spoke, there'd be a caption on the screen so you wouldn't actually hear them talking. And I thought, this is a composer's it's a composer's dream, you know. Compose 70 minutes of music and there's no talking over it. So it did that. A few years later, he decided to shoot some more material and have Donald McCann playing an older version of the person he played, of the bishop, actually, he played in the earlier one. So he added some scenes, and this film was called The Bishop's Story, which is the same, basically it's the same film as the Budawani film, with some newly shot scenes. But all the music is the same. I think that's quite extraordinary for Bob to have the trust in me to do that. I think it's extraordinary in Irish film terms. I think nothing to do with my music, but I think Bob Quinn has made a real masterpiece in that film, and you know it stands to the test of time.
Well, the music is a huge part of it, obviously, given the nature of the film. This is part of the AFI Documentary Festival.
Yeah,
and it won't be your only.
No, a few nights later, nights later on the 27th.
That's Thursday week.
The filmmaker Brian Lally has made a documentary on me.
Right.
On my life and my music. And it's 1 hour, 45 minutes, which seems a lot. But he actually left out loads of stuff.
Yeah.
He could have done two of them.
Yeah.
A whole series. It's great. I mean, I met Brian at the 2004 Galway Film FLA when I went down there, and he just said, I love your music, and he'd seen Budawani and a few other films that I'd done music for, and over the years he filmed me whenever I was in a concert. He just one camera at the back of the hall, and this progressed. He filmed practically everything I performed, and when I got the grant to do the opera Heresy in 2016, he decided, right, I'm going to really do a documentary using all the footage I have, and I'm going to film the rehearsals and take the whole thing through to the opening night and beyond.
He clearly has that obsessive streak that we talked about earlier. Yeah.
When you get you never get one a text from Brian, you get five, six even.
And are you comfortable with the term, because it's used here in relation to the movie Godfather of Irish Electronica?
I don't mind it.
Yeah, it's nice to get the recognition.
It's all right.
All right, here's a track called Acacia, which is from your own album, Frail Things in Eternal Places. And, we can talk about this after, so unless there's something you want to say in advance just to tee it up.
Oh, just the amazing singing. I've met some great singers when I did my opera. And Morgan Crowley is one of the greatest singers this country has. You can throw anything at him. You can score something and show it to him, and he'll say, how would you like that sung, this way or this way or this way? And you can also collaborate and give him something to work from, which is what this one is. And also on this track is my wife, Mary, who appears as a sprite in the background. But Morgan, wait till you hear what Morgan does, and it's just so beautiful to be able to work with somebody like Morgan.
Okay,
here we go.
Acacia. And that's called Acacia, music from Roger Doyle from Frail Things in Eternal Places. And Roger, you were saying that the two voices on there, your wife is the sprite, but the voice there, the singer, is Morgan...
Morgan Crowley, who can sing. He's a countertenor and a tenor, but he can sing low notes. He can do anything, basically.
Extraordinary, isn't it?
And to work with him in the studio was just a dream. And he played the lead role in my opera. He played the role of Giordano Bruno. And I said to him once, you've the voice of my dreams. Hope you're listening, Morgan.
All right, so before we play our last choice, just to mention again, this Tuesday at 6:30 at the IFI, The Bishop's Story, the movie formerly known as Buddhawani, it's an extended added to a version of that to which Roger composed the soundtrack. That's being screened at the IFI as part of the IFI Documentary Festival. And then Thursday week, also at the IFI, there will be a screening of a documentary about Roger. What's the documentary called?
It's called The Curious Works of Roger Doyle.
The Curious Works.
And there'll be a Q&A afterwards with the filmmaker Brian Lally and myself.
Very good. And that's Thursday week at the IFI. That'll be worth seeing that. I hope that gets a television release as well, Roger.
That's something
we should be screening for sure. And that's it, Roger. I just want to thank you for coming in. It was terrific. Great music. I knew it would be, but thanks for coming in anyway and putting all the effort into putting it together. Your last choice, Sia.
Yes.
I didn't see that coming.
No.
So please explain. Where'd you hear it?
I sort of heard it on the radio, on you know,
2FM.
Yes. I mean, I do check out 2FM. Yeah. And all the commercial stations every now and then. And I hear there's other good stuff around right now.
Oh, there's lots of good stuff.
Yeah. I don't bemoan the deterioration of pop culture.
As someone who, you know, is skilled in studio work and studio production, you mean the production levels are extraordinary these days, you know. And on this, it's amazing.
This is kind of, she's such a great singer, but the melody swoops up high, and the production is great, and it's so dramatic. I suppose it just makes, as I've said before, once it makes that emotional connection where you feel as though your whole life has been transformed when you hear something like this, that you're kind of suddenly in touch with that amazing dream you had last night or something like that, you know, put you in touch with other worlds, something like that. And it's kind of operatic as well.
Roger, thanks a million for coming in. Thank you. See you tomorrow at 7 here on RT Lyric FM. And Ian McGlynn is next with Sound Out. Roger Doyle, thank you. Party girls, don't get
hurt. You've been listening to a podcast of Mystery Train with John Kelly. Mystery Train hits the rails every Sunday to Thursday at 7 p.m. on 96 to 99 RTE Lyric FM.